want to start today by talking some more about DNA structure. And last time I brought the fiddlesticks model, and this time I brought a slightly different one, namely this one made out of zoobs, which also illustrates that you have a double helix. You have a sugar-phosphate-sugar-phosphate chain on each side, and you have base pairs across the middle, always one purine and one pyrimidine. Now, one of the questions we did not get to last time is how are the two strands oriented with respect to each other? Now, I'm going to draw it first, and then we'll do a demo. Suppose we had, say, AGCTTA. So this is a single strand of DNA. Which end is the 5' end? This one? This one? It's this one. So this is 5' to 3'. Now, if I write in the complement, what would have to go here? T, C, G, blah, 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 A, A, T. But now, which is the 5' end of the bottom? Remember, strands are always anti-parallel. So in fact, this is the 5' end, this is the 3' end. Now, one way of demonstrating this is suppose this is a tetranucleotide. Because of the 5', 3' business, every chain has a 5' end and a 3' end. In this case, it's arbitrary which is which. But when we have the other chain, it could be that the two are like this. And in this case, they're anti-parallel. This one runs this way, that way. On the other hand, they could have been parallel, in which case they'd be like this. Both of them run in the same direction. Now, there was X-ray crystallography evidence that, in fact, which way it was. If you take a DNA molecule and you take the pattern and you turn the DNA molecule around, you get the same pattern. Now, to give an example of what we mean, if I take a picture of this and I turn it over, I'm not going to get the same picture. But if I take a picture of this and I turn it over, I'm going to get the same picture. So now if we come back to our DNA, if I turn this one over, will I get a different picture? Notice I will, because it has a head end and a tail end. Not only does each chain have it, but the molecule does. On the other hand, what if it's, that would be parallel. What if it's anti-parallel? Each chain has a head and a tail, but does the double-stranded molecule. Notice if I turn it over, the sequence is different if I start from the top, but the overall structure is the same. There is no distinction, really, between the head and the tail. They're the same. An anti-parallel is what DNA is. It follows from the X-ray crystallography and from model building that DNA is anti-parallel. And this turns out to be very important because every time you make a complement, the complement, whether DNA or RNA, is anti-parallel to the template. And we'll see what the implications of that are later. Now, if you look closely at this, maybe you can see in the back because of the color. On this chain, we have a red ball, a silver ball, a red ball, a silver ball. So it goes this way. But on this one, actually, it's the opposite. We have red, silver. So it actually reads down. So these two chains are anti-parallel, and that's very clear. You don't need to look now, but when you get home, you can look at handout 10.3, which has a drawing of this, which shows it very clearly. And I will bring another model to next time, which shows it also. Now, the next thing that's in your notes is about base stacking. And I'm just going to mention it briefly, and I'll bring a better model next time. I couldn't carry them all today. You can see from this that all the bases, pairs, are on top of each other. But it looks from this like they're fairly far away, and it looks like a base pair is a rod. But a base pair is actually a flat pair of conjugated rings. And this pair is on top of this pair is on top of this pair. They're quite close, and there is an interaction which strengthens the helix, a weak hydrophobic interaction between this pair of conjugated rings and this pair. And I will bring a model next time that shows it more clearly, or you can look in your books. Now, there's one other aspect of DNA structure that we have to consider, or at least mention, before we go on. How long is DNA? If I take the DNA of an E. coli, it's about 3 million base pairs long. And if you look at models of a double helix, you can see that each base pair is about 4 angstroms from the next base pair along the ladder. So it's 4 angstroms per base pair. Now, I'm not going to work out the calculation, but it's in your notes. That if you figure it out, the whole DNA molecule of an E. coli would be 1.2 millimeters long. How wide is an E. coli? An E. coli, on the other hand, is much, much smaller than that. This is about the size of a pinhead. And people have calculated that about 20,000 E. coli can fit on the head of a pin. Now, we're not talking angels here. We're talking real bacteria. So you can fit 20,000 on one pinhead, or if you lined them up one after the other, it would be 600 across. So what this implies is that the DNA must be folded upon itself, not stretched out, in order to fit into a bacterium. And indeed, DNA in living things is always what people call supercoiled. It is folded back upon itself, somewhat like a twisted telephone coil. In eukaryotes, in the cells of eukaryotes, there are specific proteins associated with the DNA that help it coil, and we'll talk about them next time. So we're not going to talk about the details of supercoiling, just that it has to exist. Now, Watson and Crick mentioned that there were genetical aspects of the molecule that did not escape their notice, meaning they were important. But I want to talk first a little bit about the non-genetical implications, and then we'll come back and talk about the genetical implications, namely, how does DNA do its two jobs? But to come back to the non-genetical, DNA is double-stranded, according to all models. So we usually draw it something like this. It's a double helix. Now, DNA can be separated into single strands. And this process is called denaturation by analogy with proteins. There are three processes that we're going to talk about now. They are denaturation, renaturation, and hybridization. Now, if you heat up a protein, you break the weak bonds and it unfolds. If you heat up DNA, you break weak bonds and it unfolds. For example, if you have double-stranded DNA and you heat it up, it comes apart. Now, what we want to consider is, what can you learn from denaturation? What can you learn from renaturation, which is putting it back together? And what can you learn from hybridization, which is a variation on renaturation? So for the moment, let's just consider the denaturation part. If you were to heat up DNA with increasing temperature, and you were to measure the percent which is single-stranded, because your starting DNA is double-stranded, you would get a curve that looks sort of like a titration curve. That is, you have almost no single-stranded DNA. The double-stranded helix holds together to a critical point. And then within a very narrow range, the DNA falls apart into its two halves, Watson and Crick, so to speak. Now, the midpoint of this transition is called the TM, or the melting temperature, because the DNA goes from being a rigid rod to floppy individual molecules. What good is the melting temperature? Well, what did you have to do to take it apart? You had to break all those weak hydrogen bonds that were in the molecule. The more hydrogen bonds there are, the higher the melting temperature. So if you have a bunch of molecules that are all the same length, will they melt at the same temperature? You have to think back. Does base composition have anything to do with this? Is a GC pair have the same number of hydrogen bonds as an AT pair? Now, we didn't go over that carefully last time, but the answer is no. And if you look back at your handout later, you will notice very carefully that G and C have three hydrogen bonds connecting them, and A and T have only two. Now, people often draw it like this, but I want to make it clear that this is not a triple bond or a double bond. This is three weak bonds versus two weak bonds. Now, why does this matter? If you have all A and T, you have a relatively low number of hydrogen bonds, easy to take apart, lower TM. But the more GC you have, the more H bonds. So you can see, as the proportion of base pairs that are G and C gets higher, the number of H bonds goes up, and the melting temperature goes up. Now, what this means is that you can get the proportion of G and C in your DNA just by heating it up and seeing at what temperature does it fall apart compared to a standard. When Chargaff measured the proportion of A, T, G, and C in different DNAs, he had to use tedious chemical methods. But today, you don't have to do it that way. Today, you just have to heat up your DNA and measure its TM. Now, let's see if you got it. Suppose you have DNA, which is 42% G and C. What I want you to do now is I want you to tell me, what is the percent of A? Now, I don't want you to raise your hand. What I want you to do is think about this for a little bit and discuss it with one of the people next to you, two or three people, and arrive at a consensus. What is the percent A, and how did you know? So I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to talk about it, and then we will either take a vote or call on somebody. Okay, I think this is a pretty easy one, so we'll stop for a minute. We did about a minute. What percent A? Can you tell me? You got 29. Anybody have another number? Well, nobody's willing to admit it anyway. This happens to be the correct number. Now, how did you know? How did you know? I won't ask you. Somebody else tell me. How did she know?
You know that the 100 minus 42 is the percentage of A and T, and you know that A and T are complementary, therefore you divide the percentage of A and T by 2 and the 100% A.
So I don't know if you heard what he said. He said whatever isn't GC is AT. So 100 minus 42 is AT. But of the GC, half is G, half is C. Of the AT, half is A, half is T. Because we know, in other words, that A equals T, G equals C, and A plus T plus G plus C equals 100%. So from the melting temperature, one can get the entire base composition, the proportions of A, T, G, and C. Well, okay, that's what you learn from denaturation. What about renaturation? Now, if we denatured with heat, if this were a protein and we cooled it down, would it refold? If we denaturate it with heat, it would not. It would, in fact, when you boil your eggs and you cool them down, do they reliquefy? No. When you denature protein with heat, it becomes stuck in the denatured position. It coagulates or precipitates, and it does not refold. Now, some of you said yes because you're thinking of the Anfinsen experiment. If you denature the protein gently in dilute solution with chemicals and take the chemicals away, then the protein will indeed refold. But if you cool it down, the protein won't, but the DNA will. So if you cool it down, then, of course, you don't have one molecule of each. You had many double-stranded molecules. You now have many single-stranded when you heated it. And when you cool it down, every Watson finds a crick, and it renatures, and it goes back to the way it was. And this is a very important property of DNA and RNA, of nucleic acids, that they will renature. So if I cool it down, Watson will find crick. They will bang around until they form enough hydrogen bonds, and then they will go back to the way they were. Now, what we know what you can learn from denaturing. What can you learn from renaturing? Well, if you have a mixture of DNA molecules, and some are common and some are rare, who will find a partner first? They're looking around, bouncing around. Those who are common will find a partner first. So from the rate of renaturation, you can sometimes deduce proportions. But the most important part of the renaturation business, the thing that people use it for the most, is not by rate measurements, but for this technique that is called hybridization, which is a variation on renaturation. Now, the idea there is that you have two kinds of DNA molecules, not one. Not one of each, but many. You denature them, you heat it up, and now you have a mix. What will happen when you cool it down? Will purple go back with purple, and white Watson with white crick, etc.? Or will they get mixed up? If they are identical in sequence, then a white Watson can go with either a purple crick or a white crick. It isn't going to make any difference. But somewhere in the mixture, you're going to get hybrids. Hybrid molecules where Watson came from one original sample and crick from the other. The ability to form a hybrid is a measure of the similarity between the purple DNA and the white DNA. Now, again, to do an example, I actually have here two different strips of Velcro, two different DNAs. Each one has a Watson and a Crick. So if I were to denature them, since in terms of sequence they are the same, either Crick can go back with either Watson. But now, wait a minute. How am I going to do it? Do they have to be parallel or anti-parallel? They actually have to be anti-parallel. Remember, whenever you make a double helix, they have to be anti-parallel. So I can make a hybrid, but the two strands are going to be anti-parallel. Actually, whether it's a hybrid or whether it paired with its original. Now, you can see if the purple and the white or the red and the green, orange and the green are identical, you can form a hybrid. But I said you can use this to test the degree of similarity between purple and white. They do not have to be identical. If they are similar, then when they form a hybrid, some of the hydrogen bonds form, but say they don't match here, but the rest of it matches. As long as enough sequences match, the two will stick together and form a hybrid. How are you going to tell how well matched they are? Let's suppose you have this one, which is perfect, and this one, which isn't. How would you tell them apart? Now, why don't you think about that? I'm going to give you, instead of just picking the fastest person here, let's just think about this for a minute. You can talk to your neighbor. You can think about it yourself. So you get 30 seconds. How are you going to tell them apart? Somebody, and if you didn't know, you could blame your partner. But instead, I will ask for a volunteer again. Now, what have we just talked about that you could use? What do you think? You. No, in the back. Yeah.
The melting temperature?
Sorry. The melting temperature, in what way?
Because you can tell how many hydrogen bonds they have.
Which of these would have a higher melting temperature?
The one with the, on the right.
This one will have the same melting temperature as the original. Or if these were different, the average of the original. But this one will have a different melting temperature because not all the hydrogen bonds are reformed. So the TM tells you how well you have reformed your hybrid, how well you have renatured or hybridized, and that tells you a degree of similarity between purple and white. All right. That's one use of hybridization, and that's been used extensively to measure evolutionary relationships between different organisms. But the primary use of hybridization in molecular biology is for another purpose. It is for identification. How do you find out if you have an enzyme in your sample or not? A particular one. What is the test for the presence of an enzyme? It is its enzymatic activity. You assay the enzyme. You provide the substrate. New, do I get any product? That is the test. Well, how do you know if you have a particular DNA or RNA in your mixture? What is the test for that? You use a variation of hybridization. You take your sample and you denature it. And then you add a short, known, single-stranded molecule. Now, if one of these has the complementary sequence, then your known molecule, which is known as a probe, will stick to it. The probe is usually fairly short, and it is labeled in some way, with radioactivity, with fluorescence, something. So I have here an example. Let's say I realize, maybe we can fit them up here. Here's one DNA molecule. Here's another one. So these are single-stranded. This would be my probe. Now, in real life, my sample would be much longer, but it's too floppy. My probe is usually at least 20 nucleotides long, but it's not very long. And one end of it has some sort of something attached to it, a tag, that I can follow. So now I mix this together. So they have to be anti-parallel. If this is complementary to one of these, it will stick to it and hybridize and get trapped. And I will know that I have found the complement of this. Now, if you look here, it won't stick to that one, but it actually would stick to this one. But I have to do it this way. I have to make them anti-parallel. The red tags are the 5' ends. I could do it this way. So the ability of this molecule to trap the probe says that this is the complement of the probe, and the original double-stranded molecule was the same as the sample that the probe came from. So this business of detecting an RNA or DNA almost always depends on its ability to trap a probe. And we will talk about many examples of that as we go. Yes? How similar do they have to be to hybridize? It depends how you set it up. You have to form a certain number of hydrogen bonds to hybridize, to stick together at any given temperature. So if you do, you can do hybridization under a varying set of conditions, which are called stringent or non-stringent. Under stringent conditions, only a perfect pair will stick together. Under more relaxed conditions, anything similar will stick together. Depending on what you want to do, you might do it one way or the other. Are there other questions about this before we go on? Yeah?
Can the different strands stick together in different places, or does it line up exactly as it was originally?
Can the two DNAs stick together, the single strands stick together in different places? If they have none repeating sequences, there is only one way they can align. If the same sequence is repeated in one of them, then they can align in more than one way. Now, this is basically, I think, what I wanted to say about the non-genetical implications. And now I want to talk about the genetical implications of DNA structure, of the fact that it's a double helix. And we want to ask, how does DNA do job number two? That is, how does one DNA make two? Now, for this, you want to look at handout 11.1. Which describes a very famous experiment called the Meselson-Stahl experiment. Now, before we consider the experiment, let's consider what's the issue here that we wish to settle. We have double-stranded DNA. Now, as we explained last time, and as Watson and Crick immediately noticed, the two halves are self-complementary. And so the way you would expect DNA to replicate is you would expect the two strands to separate, the hydrogen bonds to be broken, the two strands to separate, and then each would act as a template to line up nucleotides and make new complementary strands. So each molecule would have one old strand and one new. That's called semi-conservative replication. It's conservative because you save what you had. It's semi-conservative because each molecule is half old and half new. Now, what are the other possibilities? That may seem the obvious one. But if you're going to do an experiment to prove this is correct, you have to also not only support this model, but rule out the alternatives. So Meselson and Stahl started thinking, what else could it be? Well, one possibility is what people call conservative replication. In that case, the two old strands end up together, and the two new strands end up together. So you go from one molecule to two, but one of them is all old, both sides, and one of them is all new, both sides. Now, we're not considering how this could happen, just that it's possible. Now, there is a third kind of replication, which is called dispersive. There are several variants of it, but the basic idea that makes it different from the other two is that each individual strand of the DNA now has parts that are old and parts that are new. Notice in these two, each individual strand is all white or all pink, all old or all new. But in dispersive replication, it's mixed. And this is just an example. It could be, say, like this. Now, how are you going to tell these cases apart? You need the equivalent of white and pink chalk. You need to be able to tell old strands from new strands. What is the obvious candidate? Do I have a suggestion? Carbon 14. Why carbon 14? Because it's radioactive. The obvious thing is to use a radioactive tracer so that one, let's say the new ones are radioactive. Well, that would allow you to identify, if you fished out a single molecule, you could say, oh, it's old, or oh, it's new, or it's half old, or it's half new. But that would not allow you to separate molecules that are all pink from molecules that are all white. You'd have to fish out a bunch of individual molecules and check each one. What you want to be able to do is to separate old from new. You can't separate C14-containing DNA with trace amounts of C14 from DNA containing regular carbon. So the trick to this is to use a different label, to use an isotopic label, but to use a density label, not a radioactivity label. If you use isotopes of significantly different densities, then the white and the pink sections will be slightly different and will be separable. So before we get into how they did it, let's consider what is the basic experiment. How did they use isotopes to label differently old and new? So they started out by growing bacteria. They grew cells in medium in which all the nitrogen was N15. So they grew them a long time, and the only source of nitrogen was N15. Now, this has one extra neutron compared to regular nitrogen. It's not radioactive. Then they took the bacteria out of that medium and washed them off, and they put them into new medium that had N14, ordinary old nitrogen. So this nitrogen is a little heavier per atom than normal. This is normal, or so-called light. And they waited exactly one generation. So that means the DNA has doubled once. So it either looks like one of those three cases, but we don't know which. Then what they did was to break the cells open and make an extract. And from that, they got the DNA. So they have purified DNA. And the question is, does it look like this, or like this? Now remember, they originally started by growing the bacteria in medium with N15. So at This point here, after long growth, all the DNA has N15 in it for nitrogen, and it's relatively heavy. So this is a heavy, heavy molecule. So if you had conservative replication, you'd have half heavy, heavy molecules, and half all new made with N14, light, light. But if you had semi-conservative replication, then each molecule would have one chain which is heavy and one which is light, and would be intermediate. And if you did dispersive, every single chain would be intermediate. So this would be some kind of mix of heavy and light. Now, in the handout, this is called a hybrid molecule, HL. This has nothing to do with hybridization. It should say intermediate. That would be much clearer. This was not made by taking two things apart and putting it back together again. This just means that this is hybrid is in the sense that it's in, that it has one side one way and one side the other. All right, now how are you going to tell these apart? So now we want to come back and look at the top of your handout, which describes the method. What you use is equilibrium density centrifugation. Now the idea is you have a test tube, and in that test tube you put a solution of salt or sugar, which is fairly heavy, lots of sugar or lots of salt. What they actually used was cesium chloride. Then, what's going to happen if you centrifuge this for a long time? It starts out like this. This is a heavy salt, so it's going to be pushed toward the bottom. But it's not heavy enough to precipitate. So what's going to happen is it's going to form a gradient of more salt on the bottom and then less as you go up. Now that means that the density of the solution increases as you go down. So the solution is relatively dense on the bottom after you've spun the centrifuge a long time. Less dense here, less dense here, less dense here. So suppose we had in there a mixture of molecules, and some of them were light, and some of them were heavy. So these are light, and these are heavy. So light means N14, heavy means N15. If we centrifuge for a long time, what happens? Well, if this molecule is lighter than the surrounding solution, it floats up. If it's heavier than the surrounding solution, it sinks down. Until after a long time, all the lighter molecules are up here. Remember, this is a centrifuge tube. And all the heavier molecules are down, heavier molecules of DNA containing N15 are down here. Now, it turns out the DNA containing N14 and N15 differ by about 1% in their density. But this method is sufficient to separate the two. If you mix pure N14 DNA and pure N15 DNA, you get two distinct bands. Now, we talked about ultracentrifuges before. How is this different than what we talked about before when we were talking about characterizing proteins? This, as it says on your handout, is called equilibrium density centrifugation. And what you did before was called sedimentation velocity. Now, this equilibrium density separates on the basis of density. Sedimentation velocity separates on the basis of size. Is proportional, remember, how fast things go down the tube is proportional to their mass and inversely proportional to friction. So if you had big balls and small balls, you put them on top and you turn on the centrifuge. If there is a gradient in here, it's made beforehand, or there may not be. And now when you turn on the centrifuge, what happens? The big balls go farther, and the small balls go not so far. So here, if you spin this one forever, what happens? The answer is nothing. Once it reaches equilibrium, it stays that way. This takes a long time. If you spin this one forever, what happens? Everything ends up on the bottom. So this is relatively a short time to see who moves faster. So this is like separating ping pong balls and golf balls. They're about the same size, but they're very different in density. This one is like separating small rubber balls, like for jacks, and big rubber balls, like for kickball. So that's the difference. So they used this technology. They grew the cells a long time in N15, one generation in 14, broke them open, extracted the DNA, and ran the DNA in an equilibrium density gradient. And the question is, what did they get? Well, what would you get? Let's start with this one, conservative. These two, how many bands would you expect in the tube? These two differ in density, so you'd expect two bands, one for light-light DNA and one for heavy-heavy. What would you expect if DNA replication is semi-conservative? You'd want one band, and it would be in between density, intermediate, so I'll draw it here. What if DNA replication were this person? Well, it's not clear what you would get. You probably wouldn't get a sharp band because some molecules would have more pink, some would have more white, so you get something in the middle. Maybe a sharp band if they all had the same proportion, maybe not. But you certainly would get something in the middle. Well, Meselsons and Stahl analyzed their DNA this way, and after one generation, all the their centrifuge tube looked like this. All their DNA was of intermediate density. What does this tell you? Does that prove that DNA replicates semi-conservatively? Does it rule out any of the other possibilities? It's consistent with this one. Which one does it rule out? Notice it can't be conservative. It could still be dispersive, although that's ridiculous, but it could be. And they needed to do another experiment to really be sure to rule out dispersive. And they actually did two different things, and one of them I'm going to ask you to predict the result. They repeated the experiment, and the only difference is they waited two generations in N14 before they extracted the DNA. So they started with DNA that was all N15, and they waited two generations. So that means the DNA doubled twice. And then they broke the cells open and extracted the DNA and ran it on a gradient. So I have a question for you. In this case only, how many bands would they get? And what density would they be? So they're taking DNA after two generations in N14 and examining it by this method. How many bands and what density of each band? One or more. So this is one, again, I want you to talk to the person next to you or the two people next to you and give it a shot. You may need a piece of paper. What do you expect to find? this one up by taking a vote. Now, since I don't want you to be influenced by your friends and neighbors, I'm going to ask you to do something really silly, and we're going to vote whether it's one, two, or three bands, and I'm going to ask you to close your eyes. Just for a minute. Close your eyes. How many people say one? How many people say two? How many people say three? Okay, now you can open your eyes. There are a few ones, a lot of twos, and a medium number of threes. Will somebody defend three? Don't have to say three. Just because you volunteer doesn't mean you said three. Will somebody defend three? You're all chicken, huh? Yeah.
Well, I mean, everyone has heavy and light. The combination of that are heavy and heavy.
So you're saying you start with this, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So if you have two of those, you can end up with heavy, heavy.
How do you get a heavy, heavy if all the new strands you make are light? You're thinking of hybridization. If I were to denature a whole bunch of these, some of the heavy could meet heavy, and the light could meet light, and the heavy could meet light, which is true. But we're talking about new synthesis. So since we're talking about new synthesis, what has to happen is each of these has to come apart. And now it has to be a template for newbies. We have to use new material. And what's the new material made out of? It's all N14. So the new strands are all going to be like that. So you're in fact going to get two bands, as everybody said, and they're what's the tube going to look like? Are we going to get a band here? This is heavy, heavy. No heavy, heavy. Only intermediate and light, light. Okay. Now, it's a good idea when you get home to try and do the same for these two to see how they would look. And the point that is important is that this would look different. We've already ruled this one out. We don't care. But this one would look different. They did, however, another variation, which I want to mention briefly because it uses denaturation, and it's drawn on your handout as well. We have been comparing native DNA molecules undenatured. So we compared these. Now, what if instead I were to heat up this DNA and then separate the mixture by density? Or heat up this DNA and separate the mixture by density? Could I tell these two apart? Well, if you look at your handout, I've actually drawn it. If you denature this, you get all pinks, and half whites. But if you denature this one, you get exactly the same thing. But we rolled this one out already. But what if you denature this one? You don't get all pink and all white. You don't get a sharp band of heavy and a sharp band of light. You get a broad band in between. And so they did that. They denatured the DNA first and then ran the gradients. And from that, they confirmed that it was this case they were dealing with, semi-conservative. The first experiment rules out conservative, and the denatured DNA experiment rules out dispersive. So this experiment both supports the Watson-Crick model of how it works and rules out the only alternatives anybody can think of. So are there questions about this experiment before we go on? Well, if not, I have a question for you. If you put some DNA in a test tube, will you get more DNA? Does DNA replicate itself? You need the raw materials. Aha. So you put in the DNA. You put in the long DNA to act as template. And you add the raw materials, the nucleotides. Will you get DNA? You forgot the magic word. Enzymes. You actually need, whenever you make anything, You have to worry about all of this. Oh, there's something else you have to worry about. When you make anything, you have to worry about enzymes, right? But you can cheat. You can look up there. You also need to worry about something else. Delta G's, energy, and so forth. So we've taken care of the template problem. Anytime you make a non-repeating polymer, like proteins or DNA or RNA, you have to have a template to line up the monomers. But just like you were making a small molecule, you have to worry about enzymes and you have to worry about energy. And so what we're going to talk about now, first the energy problem, and then we'll talk about the enzyme problem. Now, for the energy problem, you want to look at handout 2, 11.2. Somebody said that in order to make DNA, you would need nucleotides. You would need the raw materials. So how would you make DNA? The obvious thing, if you had a chain already, I'm going to cheat and leave out some of the phosphates. Well, if you were going to grow this chain, of course, you'd need a template. Now, the template's not shown on this picture to keep it sort of simple, but you need a chain that was something, say, like this. If the next thing you were going to put in was T. So let's say you wanted to put in T. The obvious thing is you'd have thymine mononucleotide, monophosphate, TMP. And the obvious thing then is to remove water here and make a phosphodiester bond, just like it shows there with reaction 1. And then you'd have a chain that would be one longer. That seems like the obvious thing to do. What is the free energy change for this reaction? Now you look at your handout. The standard free energy change, delta G0, is plus 7 kilocalories per mole. Now, that means with any reasonable number of reactants and products, which way is it going to go? That-a-way. Now, it's the delta G that matters, not the delta G0. But unless we have a huge supply of these, the delta G is going to be that-a-way. Now, you have an enzyme for this. But as your handout indicates, that's because you use the reaction the other way. This reaction is used for hydrolysis of what you eat. Even if you are a vegetarian, you eat DNA. Even if you are a vegan, you eat DNA, because plants contain DNA. Now, you don't want to keep this DNA whole. You don't want to transform yourself when you eat DNA. Did your mother ever say to you, if you eat another hamburger, you'll turn into a cow? Well, not if you're a vegetarian. But it's not possible. Because although you eat cow DNA, what you do to it is you break it down into mononucleotides, you hydrolyze it, and then you use those mononucleotides to build your DNA using your template. So in fact, this would give rise to TMP, CMP, GMP, AMP, which you would use as raw materials. So how do you do it? How do you link things together? It turns out that what you do is, in order to drive the reaction in this direction, you have to hydrolyze ATP. You have to couple this reaction to the hydrolysis of ATP. Now, is it enough to break down one ATP to push the addition of one nucleotide? Well, The addition is plus 7. Breaking an ATP is minus 7. You're just even. Delta G 0, 0 if I combine these. So if I want to push things strongly in that direction, I want to break two ATPs, not one. And that's why we have reaction 2 there. Reaction 2 is the reaction coupled to reaction 1 to allow you to synthesize DNA. In the parts of the cell where DNA is made, you have enzymes for this part. And in the part of the cell where you break down what you eat, you have the enzymes for the other part. So how do you do it? How do you couple the breakdown of ATP to the synthesis of DNA? How do you use the energy from the breakdown of ATP to push synthesis? And that's summarized on the bottom half of your sheet, right here. So this is the picture, except I left off the ATP, which I probably should have done. So if this is an energy scale, the idea is, if you were to take a growing chain and add on one nucleotide and release water, that's uphill, positive delta G. However, if you used a nucleoside triphosphate, not a monophosphate, 1P, but a triphosphate, and you broke these two phosphodiester bonds, now you get minus 7 plus minus 7, or minus 14, and the net of minus 14 and plus 7 is minus 7. So the net now is you make a phosphodiester bond, you break two, and it's downhill. And that's how it works. So this thing that I've drawn up here is reactions 4 plus 5 on your handout. Now, they're separated because they actually take place in two steps with two enzymes. In step 1, or step 4 on your handout, you break off pyrophosphate. The two P's stay together, but they're broken off, and you hook the C on the end to the next T through the phosphate. Now, that means that what you get temporarily is pyrophosphate, which is what you call that, which is usually written PPI, for inorganic pyrophosphate. Now, let's see about the energy part. Are we ahead? Did we break even? We broke one so-called high energy bond, and we made one high energy bond. Big deal. We're just even. But what happens to pyrophosphate is reaction 5. It is immediately hydrolyzed into two organic phosphate by a ubiquitous enzyme called pyrophosphatase. So there are two enzymes here, one to catalyze the addition to the chain, and that's called DNA polymerase. And then one to convert the pyrophosphate into 2PI. So this is reaction 4. This is reaction 5. Now, what's the delta G of this reaction? Well, we broke a high energy bond and we didn't do anything. So that's minus 7. So it's very negative. So one way to look at it is the delta G of 4 and 5 adds up algebraically, and it's very negative. So the net result here is downhill. But you can also look at it the way Dr. Chazen was talking about it. How do you pull a reaction? You remove the product. So reaction 4 could go either way, delta G 0, 0. But what is the product of reaction 4? You get your longer chain, but you also get pyrophosphate. What happens to that pyrophosphate? Wham! It is dead in the water. As soon as it's made, it is hydrolyzed by pyrophosphatase and cannot be reused. So as soon as reaction 4 takes place, we remove one of the products, thereby pulling the reaction always in the desired direction to get you synthesis. Now, the individual reactions are written out, but it's the net part that counts. And there's one piece missing. I just said if you eat DNA, or for that matter, if you synthesize nucleotides, this is what you end up with. Monophosphates. How are we going to get ourselves triphosphates? If we start with triphosphates, it's a going concern. If we start with monophosphates, we're not going to get anywhere. How are we going to get from here to here? Well, you can cheat and look at your handout. The answer is that's where the ATP comes in. So in order to convert one nucleotide monophosphate to one nucleotide triphosphate, we have to add on two phosphates. And that uses two ATP. Now, on your handout, it's written this way. Implying that the hydrolysis of ATP is what pushes this reaction 3. Because this is reaction 3. The only trouble with this picture is that is it uphill delta G-wise from ATP to ADP? No, it's actually downhill. So this part belongs in another dimension. What we're saying is when you hydrolyze ATP, which is actually downhill, you provide the energy to push this one up to where it is a going substrate. So just to say it maybe one more time, reaction 3 phosphorylates our nucleotide. Then reaction 4 takes off pyrophosphate and links the nucleotide to the growing chain. And then reaction 5 hydrolyzes the pyrophosphate into phosphate. So reactions 3 to 5 succeed in coupling the hydrolysis of two molecules of ATP every time you want to add on one nucleotide. That's the net result. So it's energetically expensive to make DNA and RNA. Let me just say right away that RNA is made in almost exactly the same way, except you use the enzyme called RNA polymerase, and you use ribonucleosides instead of deoxy ones, and you use U instead of T, but the principle, energy-wise, is exactly the same. So let me ask again if there are questions before we go on. Yes?
So reaction 3 is also 0 delta G?
Reaction 3 is actually 0 delta G. And that follows from the fact, even though it's written this way, that you break two high energy bonds and you make two high energy bonds.
So that one is pulled because you're removing...
That one is pulled because you're removing both the ADP and the nucleoside triphosphate to make DNA or RNA. Now, we have talked about the template part. We've talked about the energy part. What about the enzyme part? Well, we've mentioned two of the enzymes. If you actually want to replicate DNA in a test tube, it takes something like 20 or 30 enzymes. That's because you have to unfold the DNA. Remember, it's supercoiled? You have to unfold the DNA. Then you have to pry Watson and Crick apart. And all of that stuff takes a lot of proteins and enzymes that we're going to ignore. We're going to concentrate on a small number of enzymes, but it turns out these two are not enough. We have talked about DNA polymerase and pyrophosphatase, but we're going to talk actually about at least two more, ligase and primase. Now, we won't get to this one until next time, but hopefully we'll have time to explain why you need that one. Many of the issues in DNA and DNA replication arise from the properties of DNA polymerase. What are the features of DNA polymerase and DNA synthesis that turn out to be so important? In our pictures, how does DNA grow? The chain always gets longer on its 3' end. You add nucleotides to the 3' end, and you grow. All polymerases add only to the 3' end, so that all nucleic acid chains grow starting at their 5' end and adding on to the 3' end. Now, why this is, I'm going to leave and come back to next time. But that's how it is. In addition, all double-stranded nucleic acids are anti-parallel. Now, so what? Let's take an example and see what the consequence of all this is. So we have actually an example in the notes that suppose you have a template that looks like this. A, G, C, T, T, A, G, written 5' to 3. And then you have its complement, T, C, G, A, A, T, G. So it's 5', 3', 3'. Okay, so we want to make DNA. We want to replicate DNA from one we want to get to. So what do we have to do here? We have to take these two apart and use each one as template to make a complement. So I'll do that. Assuming we have the enzymes to do this, but let's not worry about it. Let's assume we do. Okay. So I want to make the complement to the bottom. Let's start with the bottom. I want to make a new chain. The new chain has to start at its 5' end. So are we okay here? Can I start over here? I'm making a new chain. So it would be A, G, C, T. This would be its 5' end. And I would just add on to its 3' end. Looks okay. T, A, C, blah, blah, blah. Fine. Suppose I want to make the complement to the top. How do I have to do it? I have to start on this side and go backwards. I have to do this. Now, this may seem like a parlor trick, but this is actually very useful. Because if you do this and write the bases upside down, it's completely obvious to any English reader that this is the 5' end. You read it this way. And this is the 3' end. And you don't get mixed up about parallel, anti-parallel. Well, what's the big deal? Remember, DNA is very long. So this means if I'm going to replicate DNA, I can't just take this completely apart and replicate one side down and one side up. It's too long, you'll get all tangled up, damaged, blah, can't do it. So you have to open it a little bit at a time. Now this is, let's see, I've marked it here. This one, the arrows go 5' to 3'. So this one goes this way. So I could make the complement, no problem. How would I make the complement on this one, though? I'd have to start down here and go up there. Well, if I do it again, it gets worse. And you might take a brief look at handout 11.1. We'll look at it a little bit, and then we'll finish it next time. So be sure to bring it. I mean three. 11.3 illustrates this problem. If you start with plain old double-stranded DNA, which is anti-parallel, you only open it up a little bit at a time. So now, what's with complements? I can make the complement to here, no problem. But I have to make the complement on the other side going in the opposite direction. So this is state B. I've done steps 1 and 2. Now how do I continue? I unzip a little bit more. So let's do step 3 and unzip some more. And it looks like this. Now what? Well, DNA grows on its three prime end, so I can keep growing here. I can keep adding further down, no problem, keep going. What am I going to do on the other side? My new DNA has to be anti-parallel and 5 prime to 3 prime. So since this strand goes this way, this one has to go this way. So what I've just done is steps 3 and 4. Can I just keep this up? If I keep this up, this 2 strands will be fine. They'll make a complete double-stranded molecule. But this molecule will have 1 complete strand and 1 strand in pieces. And it may hold together for now, but when the time comes for it to replicate, we're going to have a mess. So I need this enzyme ligase. The job of ligase is to join the loose ends. Now, you want to skip steps 5 and 6, because we'll come back to them next time, and continue step 7. So if I do step 7, I'm going to have this strand was continuous anyway, and now the 2 pieces have been joined using the enzyme ligase, and now I have 2 complete complements. But I have to keep doing that. As I go down, so this is 7, but now if I do 8, here I am again. This strand is made continuously, but the strand on the other side is made in bits. It's made discontinuously, and so people refer to this one as the leading strand, and the other one as the lagging strand. And you have to have ligase to seal it all up. Now, I think what we'll do is we'll stop here and next time bring back 11.3 and we will consider if you need anything else and why. In fact, what's 5 and 6 that we skipped? Thank you.